Well, I remember when I went to college in Shanghai, going from my state capital to Shanghai, it took about 11 hours in 2005 without high-speed rail. In 2016, with the high-speed rail, it's the same route, it's less than 4 hours. What is more astonishing is now they have more miles of high-speed rails than all other countries combined. Now, we are talking about 5% of the Chinese economic GDP, which is the annual growth, is larger, the growth itself is larger than the entire Australian economy.
Ladies and gentlemen, farmers, ranchers, and distinguished guests, thank you for listening to the Farm for Profit podcast, where we discuss the latest ideas, methods, trends, and techniques available to help your farm achieve higher levels of farm profitability. The Farm for Profit podcast is co-hosted by Tanner Winterhoff, the Iowa Bankerman, and David Whitaker, the Iowa Land Guy, where in tandem, they will share their ideas and advice from industry experts. Thank you again for listening to the Farm for Profit podcast. Remember, if you aren't farming for profit, you won't be farming for long. And now, here's Tanner and David.
And welcome back to another Farm for Profit podcast. This is Tanner Winterhoff, and we don't have a David Whitaker today. We got a couple of things going on. He's recovering from a foot surgery, but happy to have a longtime listener of the podcast, Q Keneally, with us. Why don't you say hi, Q?
Hey there, guys. How's it going?
We are extremely appreciative of your time for tuning in, even though Dave's in his absence. Q is here to help fill in the spot, fill the dead space, ask a little bit of questions that might be on the top of your mind. Thank you, Q, for joining us, and thank you, listeners, for tuning in. We always like the reviews that you leave us. One of the reviews, Q, that we got was from Cedric Guibord. I'm going to pronounce it Guibord, G-U-I-B-O-R-D. He said, listened, and it was entertaining. Let me tell you that. Thanks for doing this. So, Q, you're familiar with our format, but the listener might not be. About every week, we change our styles. So this is a Farm for Profit show. This is where we focus on a what's working in ag segment, run into a general topic about how we can help your farm achieve higher levels of profitability, and provide a little bit of a challenge at the end. Next week, or the next episode in the queue, is a Farm for Fun show. So that's where we talk current events, talk to somebody in agriculture like yourself, and put that together. Does that sound familiar, Q?
Yeah. Yep. You guys definitely keep it entertaining. A lot of different angles. Some are for profit and some are for fun. So it's nice to get the broad horizon on the farming industry across the U.S. So far of what I've listened to.
Awesome. So Q, for our listener, before we jump into what's working in ag, could you give like a 1 minute introduction of who you are, what your tie to agriculture is?
Yeah. So I farm on Tecumseh, Nebraska. It's kind of on the east coast of Nebraska along the Missouri River here. You can kind of see Iowa from my front door. We're row crops, corn and soybeans. I farm with my dad and uncle. I think I've been back about 8 years now. So got a little family and the farming's taken off, trying to get better, make some money. And we had a good week in the market. So looking forward to 2021 for now.
Yeah, it's a good start to the year, but not to waste any more time. We're going to jump right in there, Q. Our What's Working in Ag segment today, we have a special guest. Have never gone this route before. We have Stephen Bishop. He's a writer of humor, specializing in agricultural antics. His day job, he works for the local agriculture office and has met many outstanding farmers. His writing has appeared in numerous publications from Grit, Acres USA, Hobby Farm, Southeast Farm Press, Bee Culture, Country, American Bee Journal, and more. And the bee part is exactly why we've got him on the call with us. Welcome, Steve.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's great to be here and be able to talk beekeeping.
So, Steve, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, more than I did in the introduction, and tell us where you're coming from, because that accent is something we're going to question on.
Yeah, so I'm from down south. I grew up in North Carolina, and right now I live in between Charlotte and Asheville, so in the foothills of North Carolina, in Cleveland County, North Carolina. I'm a soil conservationist for our local soil and water conservation district. So I get to work with a lot of farmers here. This is one of the biggest agricultural counties this side of Charlotte in North Carolina. So we still have a lot of, traditional, conventional, grain farming here. We've got a lot of commercial blackberry growers, a lot of poultry. We're a big poultry county. So I get to meet a lot of characters, but also keep bees on the side and do some freelance writing. And I write some for Bee Culture magazine. So I'm always like to talk about beekeeping and agriculture. So it's good to be here to talk about that.
And that's exactly why we have you on, because I know next to nothing about beekeeping. So how are bees working for you in agriculture or in your farming business?
Yeah, so for me, it's mostly kind of a sideline type of deal. I definitely, had delusions of grandeur at one point where I wanted to be a commercial beekeeper, but it's mostly just selling honey at the farmer's market here in Shelby. But beekeeping nowadays is pretty tough. It's not like it used to be when you could go out and put a few hives in a wood line and check on them every, once or twice a year and get a little honey. You've really got to manage your bees now if you want them to survive the winter. So the big game changer in beekeeping happened in the 1980s, really. And that was when the varroa mite came to the United States. This little mite ever since has been just causing massive problems for beekeepers and bees. And basically a good way to think about a varroa mite is if you were a honeybee, you would have a tick on you about the size of a dinner plate. Oh. And so this tick, the tick would be, it would be feeding on your blood and on your fat stores. And it would also be spreading a lot of viruses and diseases. And the problem with this little mite is it's so small you can't really tell it's on your bees when you're inspecting your hives. So a lot of times you'll have a really booming hive, and then a few weeks later you'll go out there and it'll be dwindled down to nothing. So one of the biggest things for beekeepers now is monitoring for that mite. And there are some miticides that beekeepers can use to kind of keep the mite level down, but it's still a headache because it's kind of like Palmer's amaranth or pigweed for grain farmers. It's, yeah, it's growing resistant to some of those miticides. And so anyway, it's just been causing massive problems for beekeepers ever since the 1980s. So that's probably the biggest challenge to beekeeping now.
Yeah.
There are some other issues too, like, a lot of the issues that farmers are facing, like, I don't know how it is where y'all are at, but like here in Cleveland County, if you're a grain farmer, you can pretty much only grow corn, soybeans, and wheat. Those are your three options. There's just no market for anything else here locally. So even if you wanted to grow something, you couldn't sell it.
Right.
And so, unfortunately, corn, soybeans, and wheat, they don't provide much forage for bees. So soybeans, even though they bloom, a lot of times you'll go out to a field of soybeans in full bloom and you won't even see, the first bee. And that's because soybeans are actually self-pollinators. And so they don't produce much nectar because they don't really need to. So kind of a lack of forage in the landscape, a lack of diversity is tough on bees too. Then another thing that farmers are also facing is just climate issues. Like a dairy farmer here, told me last year, it says, it just doesn't seem like there's a normal year anymore. And, it's either too wet or it's way too dry. And if it's too dry, there's no moisture in the ground and there's no nectar in the plants for the bees. And if it's too wet, the bees can't fly because it's raining.
Yeah.
All these issues are kind of combining, and it just makes it really hard to be a beekeeper nowadays.
Well, it sounds like it. But so then what's the positive side of being a beekeeper? If our listener has maybe an interest or they've been, noodling around with the idea, what are some of the positives or how do you even get into it?
Yeah. So, there are some positives to beekeeping. Like I say, those challenges, those are definitely challenges, but a lot of times challenges can be opportunities too. So if a young person's wanting to get into beekeeping, maybe wants to start a sideline business or get into it commercially, if you can learn those learning curve, if you can get that learning curve down, you've got a competitive advantage then because you know how to do it. When a lot of people who try to get into beekeeping, they'll try it for 1 or 2 years and their bees will die and then they'll just get out. And so if you can get that learning curve down, there's some opportunity there. And there's basically three main ways to make money beekeeping. And, you know, the one that everybody thinks about is probably honey.
Right. That's one that comes top of my mind.
Yeah. But that's really the least profitable way. If you're producing honey on like a, you know, a larger scale, because it's a commodity just like, soybeans or wheat. And so, there's a lot of foreign, honey that comes into the United States and drives down the price. But the real way that, a lot of commercial beekeepers make money is through pollination. And, pollination is a huge business. So I think about current statistics say that about $20 billion worth of agricultural crops, depend on honeybees for pollination.
Holy cow.
And yeah, so like here in Cleveland County, we have a lot of commercial blackberry farmers. And so, the beekeepers will bring bees in on pallets. And so there'll be four hives to a pallet, and they'll set the hives down about a week before the blackberries start blooming. And then they'll leave them on that farm, and until the blackberries stop blooming, and then they'll, come get them, and they'll take them to another crop somewhere else. So they may go to, melons or something down east. And so they kind of follow a pollination, pollination around of different crops. And, the big pollination crop in the United States is almonds out in California. So I think, statistics say about 1.5 million hives travel each year to California to pollinate the almond crop. And so it's a very high value crop that is dependent completely on beekeepers for pollination. So pollination is probably the main way that commercial beekeepers make money. The third way though, that is, you know, a lot of potential for maybe people getting into beekeeping who don't want to spend a lot of money on like honey extracting equipment or traveling for pollination is actually, producing more bees. And so, you can actually sell your bees in like a little nucleus, colony, or you can, sell them in packages. And these sell for anywhere from $100 to $150 a piece.
Wow.
And so, so whenever beginning beekeepers need bees to get started, you're basically selling bees. And so that's really appealing for, people getting into beekeeping, because you don't have as much, startup cost, I guess. But the key there is learning how to keep your bees alive and in good enough condition that they can actually, produce more bees that you can sell.
Well, I never would have thought of that, but just like with any livestock, you have to start off with something and someone has to sell you the seed stock for that. So that makes a lot of sense. I just never put two and two together on that side of things. So I appreciate you sharing that. I know when we had messaged back and forth, you mentioned that there might be some financial assistance if there's someone looking at getting into bee farming. Is that an accurate statement?
It kind of depends on where you are, but there are some, there's financial assistance to farmers who are interested in maybe conservation practices that can help bees. So I'm not sure, you know, if y'all are familiar with the Conservation Stewardship Program or the Federal EQIP Program. Both of those programs are through NRCS, and the Conservation Stewardship Program, there's actually a practice called legume or native grass, introducing that to your pastures. And so you can actually get paid to drill like a clover, like a, you know, a white clover or a red clover into your pastures. And like here in Cleveland County, that helps because we're predominantly fescue pastures. So, it can kind of extend the growing season a little bit into summer if you've got some more clover in there. It also helps with like the endophyte toxin. And then it helps with fertility too, because that clover is, you know, producing nitrogen. And also the protein level. And so adding clover to your pastures can definitely help. And you can get a little bit of money through the Conservation Stewardship Program to do that. You know, the big challenge with doing that is managing the clover, because a lot of your broadleaf herbicides will, you know, have a, you know, some collateral damage to clover a lot of times. But
right.
a lot of the 2,4-D base herbicides will kind of stunt clover, but a lot of times it'll curl it up a little bit, but it'll come back. So, you know, that's one practice you can do through the conservation stewardship program. Another practice too for like grain farmers would be, there's actually a practice called conservation cover for pollinator habitat. And so basically they would pay. So let's say you have like a 50 acre field. They would pay you to take a half acre out of production and put it into a pollinator plot. And so in the pollinator plot, you would have to plant a mix. There'd have to be something that's flowering in the spring, summer, and fall.
Oh, okay. All season. That makes sense.
Yeah. So it has a more beneficial effect for pollinators. But that's another good practice through the conservation stewardship program. And then through the EQIP program, you know, I'm not sure if y'all are using a lot of cover crops where y'all are, but it's starting to catch on down here in North Carolina, you know, for soil health. But if you can put a cover crop that flowers like crimson clover into your mix,
right?
That can have a big impact for bees because they absolutely love crimson clover. And so you can get a little bit of assistance through EQIP for that. So those are some practices that farmers could look at that could help bees.
Hey, yeah, I know pollinator plots are really taking off and getting a lot of talk in our area too with like set aside acres, like CRP conservation programs, and we have a lot of pollinator plots is the big talk going in around here too, even in Nebraska.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that may be another option too for cost shares to look at CRP. We do a lot of CRP here in this county, you know, for grass planting and yeah, so that would be another good option too.
Yeah. Well, that's fantastic, Steve. I really appreciate you joining us. I really just wanted to get a sample about bees into our listeners' ears and kind of get them curious, because there's so much that I didn't know about it when I had picked up on your Twitter feed, just to go out there and learn some more. If somebody wanted to find you or reach out to you, how would they best do that?
Yeah, so I do write a lot for Bee Culture Magazine, so you can see some of my humor pieces and Bee Culture Magazine, but I also have a website called misfitfarmer.com, so you can you know, follow me on that. I do a post every week. And then I'm also on Twitter. It's at the Misfit Farmer. So any of those places you can kind of find me.
Awesome. Well, like I said earlier, I really appreciate you jumping on with us. Hope you have yourself a good day, and thank you again.
Oh, thank y'all. This has been fun. So thank y'all a lot.
You bet.
Thanks, Steve.
So, Q, do you know anybody around you that has bees, that is a beekeeper, whether it's hobby or something of the like?
I did, but that's been a while ago. They're kind of dwindling down right now, but I know they're working on some pollinator plots to get it amped up back in the area.
Gotcha. In-laws have a landlord that has some bees. Got to be really careful when we're spraying. So just one of those things that stuck out in my mind when we put things like that together. But why don't we jump into our main topic today? And listener, what we're going to focus on is the economic stance of, in my opinion, the two most powerful nations in the world, the United States and China. So extremely excited and pleased to have Dr. Wendong Zhong, the assistant professor in the Department of Economics at Iowa State University. He's been there since 2015. His research seeks to better understand U.S. farmland market, agricultural water conservation, and Chinese agriculture. So I think we got the right guy, Dr. Zhong, and his is also affiliated with the Center for Agricultural and Rural Development, where he co-founded the new ISU China Ag Center jointly with Dr. DeMont Hayes in collaboration with the Chinese Academy of Agriculture Sciences starting in 2017. He's a leading researcher for the Iowa Land Value Survey, the Iowa Farmland Ownership and Tenure Survey, as well as the Iowa Lakes Survey. He also leads the annual ISU Soil and Management Land and Valuation Conference. So I think we've got somebody here who's overqualified, Q. Welcome, Dr. Zhong.
Hey, great to see you. Happy New Year, everyone. I would say that for my credential, the most important thing you know is that I'm trained in the U.S. with a PhD from Ohio State, and my only advantage was the other speakers who joined this podcast is I can speak Chinese.
That's a good one. And I think that's valuable when we're talking about the Chinese economic status. So why don't we just jump right into this? I saw a statistic somewhere that the United States net farm income for 2020 was doing better than 2019. How do you think they've compared year over year?
Yeah, so you're right that USDA Economic Research published annual forecast of net farm income. They essentially forecasted about $35 billion more compared to last year. This represents over 40% growth. However, that I think if you break down the number a little more, the picture is less rosy than just the overall picture, because it's a reflection of a $46 billion record level government support that, with the significant part, it's COVID-19 relief. So it reflects the significant uncertainty the ag economy and the whole U.S. economy has been going through over the past year. So, and that's essentially provided some of the needed stability for the agricultural for the farmers and the net farm income. So it's not necessarily a drastic improvement in the market fundamentals for the U.S. agriculture.
So you said 40%. Is that more than normal year growth, or is that about what every year's growth is?
It is definitely much higher. So we are actually reporting the highest net farm income since we've fallen off the 2013 peak.
Wow.
So I don't want to underestimate the strength of the economy, especially as you mentioned, I work on the U.S. farmland market. So the farmland market is especially resilient. But that said, this is not necessarily reflecting in the profitability that we would like to see for a lot of the producers, who at the same time we are also seeing the concerning trends regarding bankruptcy and some of the financial stress as well.
So when we're looking at us here at home, United States, and we're thinking about exports as a real big portion of the agricultural economy, how did we do in 2020? Let's try and break it down, like grains, meats, and then an other category. How were exports for us in 2020?
I think overall that we are actually doing really well, especially that when you zoom in, for example, for the U.S.-China agricultural trade, we are about to see probably the record level agricultural exports to China ever. And my colleague Derma Hayes and I forecast that we likely will see an annual exports that exceeding $31 billion of agricultural exports to China. So to give you some broader context, so typically we'll see around $20 to $25 billion. The highest watermark, if you count everything, will be less than 28. So, and I know there is an urge to count all the increases to the phase one trade deal, but later on we can unpack. I think that probably provided some incentive, but I think it's probably not necessarily the major driving force. When you look at the numbers, we are seeing strong exports in terms of soybeans, but not necessarily exceeding the baseline 2017 level that much. We are reporting a record level exports of corn, beef, and pork. So that's why when I look at these numbers, that a lot of those are also driven by China's significant hog rebuilding efforts, which created the surge for a need for feed grains like corn and sorghum, but also that they are still at least 10% short in terms of the hog inventory due to the African swine fever that broke out in August 2018, which they lost 40% of the inventories. They have done a remarkable job, a really rapid advance that they are now only probably 10-15% less compared to the pre African swine fever level, but they are still at one time they are still having meat shortage, so that created really great opportunities for U.S. meat exports, and also they are also quickly expanding the hog herds, which means that they need this drive up Chinese domestic corn prices. So also led to the surge of the U.S. Corn exports to China as well.
So you're saying that the phase one of the deal might not have as much of an impact as maybe the farmer would think, but it has been effective, or what's your judgment of the U.S.-China trade deal?
So I think that overall, I think that the phase one deal has its pros and cons. There are a major criticism of the phase one deal is that this represents a significant departure of how we deal with trade and how we deal with trade talks and negotiations. In the past practice, typically you will try to remove tariff and non-tariff barriers that cause troubles in bilateral trade flows like U.S. and China. Say you try to tackle issues on how transparent or not necessarily that transparent when China issues approval of genetic seeds, or how China, whether China can honor the when USDA and FDA already sanctions the quality of the U.S. products, does China has to go through their domestic channels again? So these sort of the issues are the traditional negotiation. Instead, the phase one deal are more like a managed trade targets, which say that you need to buy this quantity over these 2 years. First, this is only 2 years, right? So it's only 2020 and 2021. Even if we are fairly successful, then this doesn't necessarily provide a mechanism for where things will go following that. And then secondly, is when you're looking at the targets, China promised some targets that's really hard to hit. For agricultural targets, China essentially promised about $12.5 billion more relative to the 2017 baseline. So, and because of all the factors, including the African swine fever, that China actually is getting very close to that. So I mentioned that China likely will buy probably $31 billion. China recorded in October and November the highest monthly U.S. agricultural exports to China, both at $5 billion. But even those record levels are still below the prorated targets from the phase one deal. So the phase one deal in some way is really lofty. And what really worries me is the phase one deal is not just about agricultural purchase, is also related to manufacturing goods and energy products as well, which when you're looking at this, it's had the challenges that China is unlikely to meet those targets, so which creates some downside risk for later this year, say if the incoming Biden administration do a scorecard on China's performance that's under the phase one deal, the manufacturing goods imports and energy products imports could potentially send some negative signals to the commodity markets, which will ripple and affect the commodity prices that we're seeing as well. That said, there are dramatic changes, seasonality, where you see in 2020, where in the first quarter, we see significant gaps in China's inability to buy a whole lot of products. But later on, we are seeing dramatic rises, and that leads to commodity price rally. One of the things I think we need to recognize is that China is the only major economy that recorded growth during the pandemic. So China will actually least about 2% GDP growth for 2020, where U.S. is lose about 35 to 4%, and Japan is 5% loss, and Europe is like in similar fashion. India lose about even 10%. So the significance of China and the significance of China as a customer for U.S. agriculture has become even more important after the pandemic.
Well, Q, I don't know if you were able to absorb all of that, but one thing that stuck out to me, and I appreciate you, Dr. Zhang, for saying that maybe this agreement was put together with the forethoughts of knowing they had to build up feed demand for this increasing swine herd. And it was a lot easier to agree to the amounts in that agreement because they knew they needed to stock up on their feed. Q, did you ever put a thought towards that connection?
No, not till today. That makes a lot of sense, though.
So then my follow-up question for you, Dr. John, would be the new administration, whatever it ends up looking like. We got a pretty clear picture by the time this episode airs, but the new administration coming in, what does that do you think? How is that going to affect trade relations between China and the U.S.?
So I think first, we'll probably have a more more normal dialogue and in a more polite tone. But when it comes to the substantive contents, that I think we are probably in a relation that both countries recognize the U.S.-China relation won't materially dramatically improve over the next few years. So that's where in that gloomy background, unfortunately. And when it comes to the trade, I think the trade policy will not necessarily become the top priority for the incoming Biden administration, especially when compared to the COVID-19 vaccine rollout and how to jumpstart the U.S. economy and potentially thinking about the global fiscal and monetary policy coordination. Even compared to that, maybe there are greater priority to think about whether to rejoin the Paris Accord on climate change, which potentially could open some room to work with China both on the fiscal policy coordination and climate change as well. However, I think that which also means that the first year tariff rollback and immediate renegotiation of new trade deal or signing new trade deals likely won't necessarily become a top priority. That said, there are some new development coming from China that created some strategic incentive for a lot of talks on whether U.S. should rejoin TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because in December, China joined forces with Japan, South Korea, Australia, New Zealand, and 10 other Southeastern Asian countries signed agreement creating the world's largest trade bloc called RCEP, so RCEP, Regional Cooperative Economic Partnership. So in part is to counterbalance of the deteriorating U.S.-China relations. At the same time, China also signed agreements with Europe on an unprecedented investment deal that, if approved, will be effective likely be in 2022. So those efforts, I think, will lead more discussions to urge the incoming Biden administration to reconsider the merits of rejoining the TPP accord that was orchestrated and led by the U.S. during the Obama administration, then pulled out by President Trump. From the purely the U.S. agricultural producer and industry perspective, rejoining TPP definitely will be a great booster for the agricultural markets because becomes even more important when our allies, Japan and Australia, will have even stronger economic ties with China as well.
That's a good point. I was curious what it might look like. And I think we're all curious what it might look like, if it's going to remain a priority, if it's going to be a focus, what kind of a pressure is. Q, do you think in the farmer world that China is an indispensable trade partner?
I think so. I think we need them at the table and get some more. I'm kind of more of a fan of free trade, so get the prices up there. And I think, I don't know, I come from a little bit more of a Democratic area, so we like our free trade. It seems like when there's a Democrat in the House, it seems like the prices are a little better for the area.
So then, Dr. Zhang, with your research and your understanding, is China indispensable to the U.S.?
I think so. So I think this is in the indispensable nature of the U.S.-China agricultural trade. It's a mutually beneficial relationship,
okay.
And it works both ways. From the U.S. perspective, it's really hard to find another customer who really needs these products, right? So the size and income of the Chinese market is the one that you don't want to give up, because the Chinese per capita meat consumption is still rising. China's population is still slowly rising. And to help you understand how significant the Chinese market is, that in the Midwest, we mainly are concerned about corn, soybean, and pork. But for example, when you are thinking about 10 years ago, nobody have heard of avocado in China, but now the avocado exports to China jumped over 100 times compared to the level 10 years ago. And nobody really bought a whole lot of cherries before in China, but now the Chilean cherries become one of the hot commodities. We're one of the way is because you can immediately tell this is the imported products, so you can brag to your friends and family that you've got money and you can buy something maybe your neighbor cannot, right? So so there are all sorts of kind of things that with the per capita income is rising, you see people will buy more protein and more vegetables and more higher quality products, and all these things are happening in China, right? So that's for the U.S. For China, U.S. is also indispensable in the sense that, for example, soybeans, we know that we sell, one of the saying is that one in four crops in growing, soybean crop growing in the U.S. will be sold to China, which represents 60% of all soybean exports. From China's perspective, this accounts for about a third of the total consumption they have, mainly which goes to feed the pigs. So they are constrained in land resources where they cannot be self-reliant in this regard, because China has 20% of the population, only 7-9% of the arable land. And my grandpa's village has over 1,000 people, but only 208 U.S. acres to farm in total. Right?
Wow.
So how can you, if you grow soybeans, how much money you can make? How efficient can you be? So that's why that for land-intensive products like soybeans, feed, sorghum, and other feed grains, and to some extent beef as well, that China cannot be self-reliant. And U.S. being one of the low-cost and large bulk commodities supplier, and we could really help fill in. Granted that the trade war created a whole lot of strategic incentive for China to diversify away from the U.S., and those will continue to be so, but I think that the trade patterns in 2020, especially the surge in corn, beef, and pork, shows that when we are thinking about U.S.-China agricultural trade, we shouldn't just think about soybeans. We should think about how can we achieve a better, more diverse, balanced portfolio that not only rely on soybeans, but also potentially has higher share of proteins, and I would also argue potentially consumer-oriented retail products like nuts, vegetables, wine, infant formulas, and things like those as well.
So I'm assuming that a lot of the way that the diversity and the trade can happen is due to increasing wealth. And I know you alluded to that earlier, that the GDP in China actually went up during the pandemic. How are they sitting economically in their country? How would you gauge their economy as a whole?
So I think the Chinese economy is still in solid footings, and you know, over the next decade, the general consensus is China will, on average, achieve about 5% growth, which is phenomenal. Because China started the opening up to the global economy in late 70s and early 80s. back at then, you have a much smaller pie, and growing at 10-15% is much easier. Now, we are talking about 5% of the Chinese economic GDP, which is the annual growth, is larger, the growth itself is larger than the entire Australian economy, right? So it's, in itself, it's really phenomenal to see that. And I think that overall, we likely will still see a stable and robust growth for the next decade. So that said, and while China wants to be more self-reliant on key technologies and materials, I think they will also be more deeply integrated in a global economy, and especially that when it comes to agricultural production, that's we are providing something that they cannot really be self-sufficient on. I think this is supposed to be the agricultural trade supposed to be one of the building block to build trust and cooperation rather than to try to create more tensions between these two countries.
So when economies are growing, my understanding is very small, but that means that there's a growing middle class, correct?
Yes.
What does the middle class in China prefer? What do they want to buy?
So first, to give you some understanding of the scale, that the Brookings Institute forecasted about 2-3 years ago, over the next decade, 88% of the next billion middle class, so globally, that will be people who make $20,000 household pre-tax. So 88% will be in Asia, 350 million will be in China. So that's the new growth. That's the size of the market we're talking about. In terms of what they want, I can give you some examples using my younger brother. My younger brother lives in Shanghai, and he has two kids as well. And what the middle class want is that they want a safe food, right? So China has some terrible food safety issues, with especially in 2008, there are some infant formula that get to significant birth defects. So even a decade later, when the quality is much, much better, people still don't trust the domestic infant formulas. My younger brother will buy infant formulas from Holland and New Zealand, which I would argue that U.S. can capture a larger market share, right? So that's one. They want a better life for their kids. Especially now that there is a growing demand for better environmental quality, which has direct implications on how China's agricultural production lies. That before the African swine fever, China actually implemented stringent environmental regulations on hog productions, which led to creation of many so-called no-hog counties. So these urban counties pride themselves with no-hog production at all, because in 2013, there are dead pigs floating in the rivers of Shanghai, right? So those are some of the things that these are some of the growing concerns. They also are thinking about, you are seeing a repeat of the sorting based on school quality. There are they worry about when the parents worry about when their college educated kids go to the market, how can they find a good job, a good paying job, especially during this uncertain world when a lot of the factories potentially work on export products. When you enter the trade war, they hit the Chinese manufacturing workers hard as well. Right? So I think increasingly the Chinese consumers want something that you and I want similarly as well. But the material stuff that we all want better TVs, although that in China people probably don't watch Super Bowl, right? So people watch ping pong and basketball and NBA, not necessarily the baseball and football, but still that people are enjoying the similar kind of things. And you can also see there are more people in Shanghai, for example, in urban China, people are spending more money and time eating outside in the restaurants compared to their total grocery spending as well. So this is the similar patterns that we're going through here as well.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, sounds like same kind of concerns here, like environmental. You want your food made safely in a safe manner. So yeah, kind of see that over here mainly.
So for the agricultural products, what is really interesting is we take for granted that we don't worry about the safety that much. Right. So I think people are way more concerned about safety when it comes to food, especially if this is a food for the kids. Then they become much more concerned, and often people are willing to spend a lot more money, much larger share of their money to work on that. And a lot of those spending that you can also see that this is also true that the expenditures on educations, given that many people only have one kid, and thinking about how my kid can compete in an uncertain world, in a more globalized world where the window of social mobility is also closing as well, is there people are investing way more in their education. To give you some examples, that I started learning English when I was in junior high. So I'm already, I'm 11 or 12. Now, my younger brother's kids start learning English at kindergarten, earlier. So the Chinese kindergarten, which means that they are learning this in daycare, age 3.
Wow. Right?
So the competition has been pushed way earlier in your life.
I feel like there's a joke in here about that's probably the same age Q also learned English.
Yeah, baby steps. Yep.
That's fascinating. So then what about Chinese agricultural economy? You mentioned that the hog herd is about 90 to 95% of where it used to be before African swine fever. What does agriculture look like in China right now?
So I think that the Chinese agriculture, it has different aspects. That when it comes to wheat and rice, they're absolutely secure. So they are actually okay. What is lagging behind is that their technology is still lagging behind, especially when it comes to commodity crops like we know really well, the corn and soybeans, and some of the livestock production as well. But there are some really major developments where Chinese leadership just had meetings to talk about that China want to be advanced technologies and be self-reliant on key breeding technologies for crops and livestock. And there are newer startups that they can do, especially relying on drones and remote sensing, that even though you, on average, the farm size is 1 acre, you can use agricultural drones to apply pesticide for thousands of farmers and at the same time, because they largely grow the similar stuff. There are also development in terms of the agricultural policies that before 2007, China never had crop insurance, and now they are the second largest market with crop insurance. They're mainly still doing yield-based crop insurance, but they're experimenting revenue-based products. The China just announced last week they're trading livestock, a live hog futures as well. So when it comes to agricultural markets and policies, I would encourage and challenge some of your listeners where you should think China is moving more and more toward the direction of Europe and US, not necessarily becoming more and more tightly controlled as we would think in a more totalitarian regime.
So then the last category about the Chinese economy is technology. And this is where I have a generalized opinion that they're more advanced. One of the things I've heard you talk about before is high-speed transportation. But what technological advances are you seeing happening over there?
So I wouldn't say that China's overall technological status is more advanced. So they have some bright spots like high-speed rails. So I remember when I went to college in Shanghai, going from my state capital to Shanghai, it took about 11 hours in 2005 without high-speed rail. In 2016, with the high-speed rail, it's the same route, it's less than 4 hours. What is more astonishing is that they built all these high-speed rails over the last decade. Now they have more miles of high-speed rails than all other countries combined, right? So and all these are didn't exist before a decade ago. However, when it comes to the overall technology issues that China is still lagging behind, for example, China can produce can assemble iPhone, but the key technology that is producing iPhone, the chips, are the American technology and European technology, right? So China now have aircraft carriers as well, but it's some of the major technology that is involved for that is not necessarily made in China. However, China is, again, I said China is a country of rapid change. Before 20 years ago, China was solely relying on the U.S. GPS system. Now China has the its own navigation system with the whole global-wide satellite setup in just 2 decades, right? So and China is investing heavily on CRISPR technology in the gene editing, both for crops and for both for the agricultural arena, but also for pharmaceutical arena, right? So we have better technology, for example, for the COVID-19 vaccines using the mRNA. China didn't necessarily have that, but they also have 5 leading vaccines that has some decent results as well, right? So, and the, you also need to remember, for example, that one of the base scientific work that enabled us to do the vaccine was a protein that is detected by and decoded by the Chinese scientist early on, quickly after the appearance of the COVID-19 coronavirus as well. So those capabilities weren't being there like 20 years ago either. So I think there are still a whole lot more that China it's learning where I was once international graduate students that now we have 350,000 Chinese students studying U.S. universities every year. But so those, I think, will continue to happen, assuming that they will be able to get visa to come here. But overall, I think there are there are definitely concerns on how China requires foreign companies to set up joint ventures where you worry about the forced technology transfer or implicit technology transfer. One of the new agreements that they signed with Europe promised some newer, tighter regulations on what you can and cannot do. And Tesla, for example, just set up last year the first sole-owned auto company in China. So China is becoming more loose in these regulations. And I think the U.S., for example, should push for these higher standards when it comes to the intellectual property rights protection. And frankly, the larger Chinese companies are pushing for the similar protection as well, because they own a lot of the intellectual property too.
So it does. Sounds like they're probably moving away from the stereotype that we all, I shouldn't say we all, just the stereotype that some of us have. And now I want to ask probably a tough question, a two-part question. I want to kind of wrap up the summary of the Chinese economy with today in the current environment. Which economy is faring better, the United States economy or the Chinese economy? And then if you could follow that up with where are each one of them headed? What's your prediction on how each economy is going to look like in the next 2, 5, 10 years, etc.?
So just in terms of economic growth, I think, unfortunately, I think the U.S. suffered a major loss due to the pandemic because the waves and episodes of the COVID-19 pandemic. So when it comes to the strength of the economic growth, China is projected to overtake the U.S. As early as 2028 as the largest economy. However, I want to emphasize that this is measured in GDP, which is the annual output. So you can imagine that you have a wealth chamber, but this is the gold that you produce every year. So it doesn't necessarily mean that the economic net worth is greater than the U.S., but it does represent that China in the next decade will likely will have to accept China as one of the major competitors economically, right? So when it comes to I think both countries are going through transformation. I think the U.S. is thinking about how and whether we should revitalize manufacturing jobs, and arguably, I think the intertwined global supply chain means that we probably wouldn't see the t-shirts factories showing up in the U.S. A whole lot,
right?
Because the cheaper labor in other countries. And China is also going through the similar transformation as well. They are trying to figure out how to incentivize innovations in China, not only relying on export orders, but also to satisfy the growing need. And China also has major issues when it comes to... So we have racial tensions in the U.S. society, and China also have regional disparities. And in equity among the different ethnic groups as well. So they are, I think, both have challenges. But overall, I think both still have a robust future as far as I can tell.
Very good. Well, I want to be respectful of your time. We appreciate you hanging out with us and sharing your wisdom. Q, are there any questions that you've got floating around in your head that you'd like to ask Dr. Zhang before we wrap up?
Are their minds opening up a little bit more towards genetically modified crops and stuff like that? I mean, there used to be a lot of talk of that a year or two ago, and is that kind of opening up or less concern? I mean, it's smart food made safely, so.
So I think there is a bifurcation in terms of opinions that the government definitely recognized the potential of genetically modified crops and genetic editing, especially. So I think the CRISPR editing, which has a lot more potential, so they're definitely investing a whole lot more, and China has speed up. The approval both of the seeds from the large ag company that we know, but also Chinese ag companies as well. When it comes to the Chinese public, there are still significant concerns. However, I think that the government has strong influence on how the public perception would be. That in part is because that the Chinese in previous years tried to leverage these sentiments in the public, so they didn't curb these misinformation. I think they are opening up, but this is a crop by crop as well. So people, I think China already have genetically modified cotton and papaya, and likely the crops that will be more open to genetic modification would be corn and some other feed grains that not necessarily directly become human consumed food items. So for wheat and rice, that's off the table. So that's they will be relying on hybrid for the breeding, not necessarily just the gene editing techniques.
We did have another listener question that was asked, and it was tied to former Governor Branstad. How is his relationship and the Chinese government? Did he get kicked out of China?
Well, I don't necessarily think he got kicked out of China. I think, unfortunately, Governor Branstad had a more interesting tenure than he probably originally anticipated. So the reason he became U.S. ambassador to China is because his personal relations with the Chinese President Xi Jinping, who visited Iowa in both 1985 and 2012, Muscatine, Iowa. He stayed here for about 3 days. But I think overall, unfortunately, that we overestimated the role of ambassador played in trade talks, especially in given trade talks are such specialized topics. However, I do think that especially early on that ambassador played a good role in when you are looking at all the tweets that President Trump tweeted about foreign leaders, he didn't call the Chinese leader names compared to how he treated other world leaders, right? So, which I do think that the Chinese tradition do value personal friendship and your history, so that we don't know who the next ambassador would be, and I think picking someone who can establish a good relationship with the Chinese leadership will be critical. And of course, this person for such an important post, you need to have influence towards the president like Biden as well. So to make sure that the message is passed on.
That's great. And what we like to wrap each one of our shows up with, Dr. Zhang, is the same question. And I'll give you some time to think about it while I summarize. But the question is, in all the farmers that you've met and networked with, which I know is a lot, what is a common trait or a common characteristic amongst the most successful ones? So be thinking about that while I summarize. And Q, I'm going to have you jump in for Dave on a challenge. So if you could challenge our listeners to grab something out of this message, I'll put you on the spot for that. And I'll kind of try and run through a summary here, Dr. Zhang, and then you can let me know if I missed anything. So started off talking about the U.S. and Chinese economic stance. The exports are projected to exceed the highest levels that we've historically had, even when you combine everything together. They have managed their trade targets so far through phase one of the deal. Granted, this trade agreement was only for 2 years. The Chinese are rebuilding their hog herd size. They lost about 40% of that due to the African swine fever. And then they're close to getting to that 90-95% of where they were prior to that. So that might have been more of a contributor to the increase in exports rather than the trade agreement itself. But the new administration is probably going to look at that, maybe look at rolling back some of the tariffs, maybe looking at rejoining TPP. But ultimately, the Chinese economy is really one of the rare ones during the pandemic to grow. We noticed that he shared with us too. However, both economies have a strong outlook, both the U.S. and Chinese. The middle class in China is a group that's continuing to grow. We know that they want a better life for their kids, kind of like Q alluded to, for the same with Americans. They are adopting more of a Western European and U.S. standard and outlook on policies and enacting crop insurance. They've got some technology advancements to their own GPS system, but ultimately it seems like the relationship is indispensable between the two. So how'd I do, Dr. Zhang?
I think you did really well. I do want to I want to correct that for the African swine fever, they're roughly at 90% of the pre-ASF level. Many people actually believe this may have some maybe bias of overreporting, but so roughly there. I do want to emphasize that given the change of the administration and potential reporting of how China performed on phase one deal, there still could be a downside risk in the commodity markets once we have some report out. So given there are phenomenal commodity prices now, I encourage you, if you're a farmer thinking about your marketing plan, take advantage of these prices. Don't wait for the highest number, right? Market some portion of your grain now. So I think that will help you in a bottom line. As regarding your question, I think the trade that surprised me most is when I was I spent 6 years before coming to Iowa in Ohio, but as ignorant as I am, I thought that all the farmers would be homebound and basically in Iowa, but I didn't realize how some of the most successful people are really curious and globally minded, where they many of the people I met, especially when you think about some of the people who work in the agribusiness, we often think that agribusiness are the red barn, the farm with the red barn.
Yeah.
But now it's increasingly a global business. So I met many agricultural professionals who actually have gone to Germany, Brazil, and they not only know what the Iowa agriculture is, but also knows the strengths and the perception of the agricultural products on the global stage. And I think these curiosities and some of the willingness to learn about the perspective, especially when I go out and talk about some of the U.S.-China agricultural trade issues, I'm probably preaching a message that the farmers may not necessarily fully agree, but many people still are willing to hear the truth rather than hearing otherwise, right? So I think that's something I really admire and really appreciate.
I don't think we've had an answer like that, so I appreciate that, the curiosity and the understanding of the global, just the world itself and how everything plays together. So I really appreciate that answer. I thought for sure Q, he was going to say they knew how to wakeboard, but I don't. Apparently, that's not the case. So what do you think, Q? What would be a good challenge for our listeners this week after this complex episode?
Yes, there's a lot of big words going on here. A lot of word. The main word I probably heard is growing industry, growing economies, growing, and not a lot of crops growing right now. So I take it to the operation or the owner to work on this time to grow themselves, grow their teams, grow their operation, meet people, and grow that mind and get ready for next year as we conquer this 2021 and keep growing. So I know you guys preach teamwork a lot, and that's one thing since I started listening to this is really put my team together and put my people together. And it's 2020 was one of my better years after all the stuff we went through. So just keep growing out there.
Hey, I think that was a good one. And I appreciate you, Q, filling in for Dave. If you guys want to go back and listen to the previous episode, we did run down everything that's going on. Hopefully my voice comes back a little bit better for the next time that we join us recording, but truly a heartfelt thank you to both Dr. Zhang and for Q for joining us on this episode. And listener, remember, if you found any value in this, please share it with your friends and family. We like our audience to grow. We like that network of support around us to benefit from this positive message that we've got. Gentlemen, thank you again. And listeners, thank you. Until next time, we'll see you then.
Remember, if you aren't farming for profit, you won't be farming for long.